This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of our program, how working women are transforming American life, Sally Helgeson has explored the social and economic landscape of Naperville, Illinois. She says William White's Organization Man, a mid-1950s study of young executives living in the suburbs and commuting to the city, is no longer typical. In her book, Everyday Revolutionaries, Helgeson says the challenges faced by women today are transforming American life. She writes, women living at the point where public and private concerns collide are both influencing and being influenced by the fluid and fragmented organizations to which the post-industrial era is giving birth. She says women are the key to understanding our diverse and confusing culture. You can join the discussion this afternoon with a phone call in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number to use. We also have a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Sally Helgeson is a consultant and lecturer on issues of social and economic change. She's the author of three books, including a book on women's management style titled The Female Advantage. Her latest book is Everyday Revolutionaries, Working Women and the Transformation of American Life. It's published by Doubleday. Toll free 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Sally Helgeson joins us this afternoon from the Radio Hall of Fame studios at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Sally, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste. It's great to be here.
You set off on this course, on this project, thanks to a piece by Nicholas Lehman in the Atlantic Monthly. What did he have to say in that essay?
It was a fascinating essay. It ran in, I believe, 1989 in the Atlantic Monthly. And I knew at that time, this is now, what, almost 10 years ago, that I wanted to write a book about women and the way women, ordinary women, not just women leaders, who we've been focusing on in a lot of literature, but everyday women were transforming organizations and communities, because I do a lot of traveling around, and I become convinced that this was so. But I didn't really have, I mean, it's a huge topic, and where do you start? And in Nick Lehman's article, he was talking about the old Organization Man era. And he mentioned that, and he was talking about how different suburbs were now. He mentioned Naperville as one of the places he was looking at, and I thought, that's it. I'll go to a typical edge city suburban community today. Edge cities like Naperville are where the fastest growth is in the U.S., and I'll use the work that White did in the 50s as sort of a benchmark for comparison and contrast, and that'll give me a way of getting a handle on this very broad, very diffuse, and quite confusing subject, because there is no real organization woman today who's the counterpart of the organization man in White's era, because organizations are not as dominant in our lives as they were in White's era.
A Naperville woman?
A Naperville woman.
As opposed to Organization Man?
I don't know. Maybe that's a... I guess Everyday Revolutionaries is the title I've come up with as a contrast to the idea of an Organization Man. Naperville is certainly typical and perhaps even an extreme example of some of the trends we're seeing reshaping American life. And what I believe and hope I've made a strong case for in the book is that a lot of the greatest changes in American life are being driven by the participation of women in every aspect of the public world. You talked about, you quoted from the book, that breakdown between public and private. In every arena, business, entrepreneurial, legal, educational, medical, military, religious, political, in all those fields, women have over the last 30 years entered the public world. And the fact that that is happening at the same time that the basis for our economy is changing with this move to the knowledge economy and that technology is being transformed gives a lot of ballast and support to this huge social and demographic change that we're living through.
You mentioned Naperville as an edge city, and I think maybe it would be useful here to talk a little bit about how an edge city differs from a suburb, the suburb of William White's organization, Man.
The typical suburb of the 50s and 60s was essentially a bedroom community. People lived there, but they didn't work there, and usually they didn't do most of their shopping there, and they didn't turn to that part of the planet for recreation. In the organization, Man, he chose Park Forest, Illinois, which was a typical bedroom community at that time. And the men, the organization men, all basically commuted by train into Chicago. You've seen those wonderful pictures of those elevated platforms filled with men wearing hats and raincoats. That sort of sums up the bedroom community. The women stayed there. The children all went to the local public school. People went to churches in the community. But for buying things and for recreation, they came into Chicago. Naperville, by contrast, and edge cities are places where businesses are as well. They're thriving business places. In fact, Naperville was basically transformed from being a small town by the presence of Bell Labs in 1964. So large organizations are putting down roots in edge cities and transforming suburbs into very different places where people work and travel in all directions.
Would you read from the prologue to give us some idea of the women you interviewed and how different they can be? And I think that that is a wonderful way to open the book, in that we hear the voices of the women that you talked with.
Yes, I'd love to do that. I want to start off with a quote that I really use as the last quote, because I think it sums up a very strong theme in the book, and that theme is the tremendous diversity that we find in today's edge city as opposed to the sort of homogeneity that was characteristic in White's era. One of the women in Naperville that I interviewed said, "One of the great things about the way people live now is also one of the problems. There's just so much variety and choice. Life today is like Starbucks. You don't just go in and order a coffee. You specify precisely what you want. A tall, double, decaf, skinny latte. That seems like the perfect metaphor for life in our times." A couple other quotes that that sort of bring forward some of the themes that I describe and try to analyze in the book. Another woman saying, "I'm 28 and already on my third career. If I'd known how things were going to go, I would have gone to our community college instead of spending all that money to go to a prestigious school out of state. As it is, I've still got at least 8 more years paying off student loans to qualify for a career I've already transitioned out of 3 years ago." That's typical of what I found, the sort of fluidity of career and jobs among the women in Naperville.
There's an amazing sense of sort of, I'm going to just do what I have to do. I'm just going to get out there and do it for myself. I'm going to create what I need. I'm not going to be held back by, you know, past ideas of what it was to be a worker, a mother, a woman.
Absolutely, and I do think one of the reasons that there's this sense of possibility, first of all, again, the technology, which enables so many people to start home-based businesses, which enables entrepreneurs to go out on their own without huge capital investments, which it used to require. There's that real sense of possibility. One of the things, Peter Drucker, his writing has always been very influential for me, and one of the most important things I think he said is the nature of a knowledge economy, once it gets underway, will begin to transform the balance of power between individuals and organizations, and that is precisely what I saw here. The organization men were dependent upon the large organizations for which they work. They were defined by them. These women are creating very customized, fluid kinds of lives that meet their individual needs, and which they use organizations in order to get the kind of training they need, in order to develop contacts, and in order to develop develop skills. But essentially, it's about what they're creating, about the kind of satisfaction that they can get from the life they're putting together.
Mm. At the outset of the book, the very outset of the book, you quote from Saul Bellow, The Adventures of Augie March, a wonderful quotation, "I am an American, Chicago-born, and I go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle, and I will make the record in my own way."
Yeah, that sums it up. That sums up that sense of possibility, that sense of individuality, and I just love this quote when I came across it because, of course, I was looking at people who were living in the Chicago area. "Taught myself freestyle, and I will make the record in my own way." I think it's a profoundly American sentiment, mm-hmm. but one of the things we're seeing is, again, because of the change in the nature of the technology and the change in the nature of the economy, more and more people are able to implement that kind of accentuation on their own individuality than have ever been able to do in history before.
You say that women are forming a new frontier, or peopling a new frontier, but in what ways is this frontier similar to the frontier of old, and in what ways is it very different?
Well, the primary way that it's different is in the old shaping of the frontier, the men went out, they founded a new community, and you know how I'm a great fan of Western movies, and you know how you always know the women have come to town when the preacher enters and the lace curtains go up and there's a school, and there's sort of a sense then when the women come out that in fact the frontier is closing, because now we've got lace curtains, so we might as well have stayed back in Pittsburgh. That's a kind of standard thing. What I'm seeing here is men and women building these essentially frontier communities, and I don't just mean it in a spatial sense, but also a frontier community in terms of possibility. Men and women building them together. You know, one of the things that I learned in the course of writing this book that was one of the most fascinating things that became apparent to me, I've never really seen it written about anywhere else, is that for the first time in human history, men and women are using the same technology, the same primary tool that is the personal computer, to do their work, which gives them a kind of common language such as they've never had before. And so what I see is communities, frontier communities, new developments, new settlements being built up by men and women, but often with women kind of in the pioneering role, partly because women move in and out of the workplace more frequently than men do, and I think that's the model for the future. It's not going to be the old model of education, then work, then retirement, or golf. It's going to be something much more integrated and take place at different periods. That young woman who talked about the fact that she regretted spending all that money for a college education, for a career that she transitioned out of 3 years ago, I think is a very important voice, because what it tells us is that in this kind of fluid and evolving economy, which offers so many opportunities but is changing so rapidly, we need to think about education in terms of a lifelong project and not something segmented at the beginning.
Hmm. Women told you that their husbands are very active in household duties, but the overall responsibility of running the house belongs to women. There seems to be a sense of women running the show. There seems to be almost a sense of men saying, "Tell me what to do."
That's exactly what I found. I think that a lot of the older complaints, the complaints that maybe you heard about 10 years ago about "he won't help" and that sort of thing, epitomized in Arlie Hochschild's very important book, The Second Shift, I found something different. I found husbands very involved, but over and over the women said, I feel like I bear the overall responsibility. I make the decisions." And then basically he asks what should be done. It was fascinating. One of the women that I talked to said that she ended her night, every night, by going downstairs into her home office in the basement and printing out the family's precise schedule, herself, her husband, the children, the grandmother who took care of the children in the morning, and the babysitter who came in the afternoon. Every one of them had a very precise sort of file of fax schedule, and that's what she printed up. And I thought it was interesting that she was also printing up her husband's schedule for him. So there is a sense of that, and in some ways the women really like that because they get to do things their way. And in other ways they feel often as if, you know, why should I be the one to make all these decisions?
Also, what a tyranny that thing that has alternately been called the day planner or the day runner. You wrote in the book about a note on a refrigerator that you saw with a schedule. 5 p.m. we're going to make dough with the kids. 5:30 we're going to decorate the cookies, and at 6 p.m. we will bake them.
Exactly. It's a fascinating thing. I call it the Filofax way of life. It pertains to children's lives as well as adults. I think it's a consequence, first of all, of the time crunch that people are in with mothers working full-time, the enormous distances people are driving now to work, the fact that in typical Edge City community, everybody's driving in different directions during the day, the fact that children have many more after-school activities. Again, going back to the organization, man, the kids were just sort of out riding their bikes in the neighborhood after school. Here kids have soccer lessons and tennis lessons and violin lessons and horseback riding lessons and extra coaching for tests. And so you end up with very intense, customized schedules. I think also the fact that a lot of households are being run by women who have very high professional skills and long experience in the work world inspires them to organize a family life in this way too. So you see families becoming a little more like work at the same time that work is offering people for greater opportunities for individual satisfaction that people used to get more just in the private or domestic arena.
So what's the quality of life of the children?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I think it's ambiguous, and I must say that I have some concerns about it. I saw that Naperville was selected in some poll or some study recently as the best place in the U.S. to raise children. Certainly the quality of schools is as high for public schools as you could find anywhere in the nation. But I found some reasons for concern and heard many mothers echo what some of my thoughts were. One woman in the book said, I worry that kids aren't getting enough woods and basement time, that they're so highly scheduled that they become very dependent upon schedules and upon adults. Mm-hmm. A counselor told me that she thought that this scheduling often led to anxiety and burnout among kids by the time they reached their teenage years. And one woman whose children, actually the woman I mentioned who goes down and does this schedule on her computer last thing every night, she said, I'm worried that my kids don't know how to take a bus. They're used to depending on us to do everything for them. But on the other hand, that's partly the consequence of the way suburbs are developing now, the way edge cities are developing, where you can't send a kid out for a carton of milk because they have to cross the highway. And also a lot of the fears that people have today about children being left on their own.
Yeah, but it seems to me that a couple of things disturb me about Naperville in terms of the children. We've maybe forgotten that you can learn a lot at play on your own.
Absolutely. And I remember one of the counselors I talked to said she worries about the kids in terms of their imaginations because you develop your imagination having kind of a lot of daydreaming time and a lot of downtime. And I think this is, I don't want to give Naperville a rap here because I see it even, I grew up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which you'd think of as still, you know, pretty slow, easygoing place. And I see it there with the middle class kids, this enormous structuring of their lives, an emphasis on achievement. So it's certainly nothing, and certainly in New York City where I live, I think you find it basically all over. I don't know about small rural communities.
It's happening here. I had a young boy tell me once not too long ago that his sister, well, she just didn't know how to manage her time properly.
Exactly.
Let's take a call this afternoon on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi, my name is Erin, and I actually grew up in Naperville. You were just talking about children and their life being very structured. I must say that some of the activities I went to were actually in the neighboring community in Lisle.
Yeah.
My parents still live in Naperville, so I was very interested in your book. And also, I just finished your other book about the female advantage, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, more specifically, I mean, how many women did you... I have a few questions, and I'll... Would
sure.
you like me to give them one at a time, or...
Let's just start with one.
Okay. Well, how many women did you talk to, and how long have they lived in Naperville?
Well, it was a complete variety. Naperville, as you know, has been highly transient, although it's becoming less transient, I think because it's a place of great opportunity. So when people's companies want to move them out of Naperville, they often elect to stay in Naperville and start their own business or work as a consultant selling their skills back to their company. So I think the transience is not what it used to be. I talked to people who had been born in Naperville when it was still a small town. I talked to one woman whose family had lived there for three generations, all the way up to people who had just moved there two or three years ago. I talked to thousands of women over the course of the 3 years I spent on this book. I lived in Naperville about 3 months a year for 3 years and really tried in every way I could to integrate myself into the community. There are probably about, I tell specific stories in the book because it's really very much in the voices of the women, and there are probably about 30 women pretty much featured thematically through the book that I use their stories. And I want to add that they're real people. I use their real names. It's not a, you know, the sort of journalistic trick of fake composite people. They're all real. They're all, you know, people in the phone book. So that's part of the method that I use. So the answer is both. Talk to thousands of people, but sort of structured it around about 30 women who I thought were fairly representative.
So as being representative, are many of them one or two income families or a variety of...
A variety. Now, one of the things that's interesting, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I became convinced of in this book is that this distinction that's drawn between women who work and women who don't is often a fake one these days. It probably was true 20 years ago, but now most of the women who are not working, most of the women that I interviewed who were staying at home presently, have worked and will work again. And this is a hiatus. It might be 5 years, it might be 10 years, but in the course of their entire adult life, it's a period and a time that they're out of work. Certainly in the single income families, there's more of a struggle. Naperville, as you know, is not an inexpensive community to live in, and but most of those are temporary arrangements, and I think that we need to keep that in mind, because the debate is often, you know, the war between women who work and women who don't, and it's an artificial distinction, I think. It's more what people are doing at that specific time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome in Champaign-Urbana. The number to use, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, good anywhere you're listening, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking this afternoon with Sally Helgeson about her new book, Everyday Revolutionaries, Working Women and the Transformation of American Life. So talk with us about the factors most critical, most important in leading us from organization man to everyday revolutionary?
That's a good question. I think it's basically three. What is so fascinating about the end of the century, the time we're living in now, is we have three enormous changes that have been happening over the last 20 years, and they're working together. The social change, of course, is the inclusion of women in the world of work. And you see many of the differences between the organization man era and our present era are really caused by that, the tremendous diversity in terms of family structure. You see everything in Naperville. You see two 42-year-old women living next to each other, and one has a new baby, and one has two children in college. And that's because we have very different life patterns now from one another, and the organization man, basically, if you were 40, you had a 14-year-old. People moved through life in the same progression. So that entrance of women into the public arena is the big social change. But what's fascinating about it is it's happening at the same time that we're having this major change in the nature of the economy as we switch from an industrial economy to a real knowledge-based economy. And we are also having this technological revolution that is enabling so many people to start home-based businesses. The very fact that you can buy for $1,500 the same computing, word processing, and connecting power in 1997 that you could buy for $1 million in 1984 has made an enormous difference in the possibilities for people. Also, just the networking possibilities and what that creates and the emphasis that gives on individual achievement, decision-making, it's phenomenal. It's extraordinary. But the fact that these three things are happening together is what really creates a very different kind of era. People often ask me, there have been periods where women have made a lot of progress in the past, and there's always been a backlash, and things have gone backward from then. I don't think that's possible right now, and I don't think it's possible not only because the social change has gone so far, but also because the nature of the technology and the knowledge economy, where organizations have to draw broadly from the ideas of people, have changed forever, and I don't think there's any going back.
You write that women have benefited significantly, greatly, but have also been made most insecure.
Yes, I think that's true. The time we live in, despite all its opportunities, and I, for one, I think I'm one of the more optimistic people I know about the way a lot of the changes we're living through will play out for people's lives, partly because I travel all the time and have spent my time interviewing thousands of people, but I feel very optimistic about that, but also it's a very difficult time we live through right now. People aren't necessarily adjusted to the idea of always having to make your life as you go along, this sort of constant improvisation that our environment provides an opportunity for, but also kind of forces us in. It's an insecure environment. It's not one where we have a great deal of institutional support. And particularly for women, that's true. I mean, it's a time when we need community more than we've ever needed, and yet women who, at least in this country, have traditionally been the community builders, especially in frontier outposts, are too busy often to be that involved in the real work of building community. So it's a time that's difficult to negotiate, a time where we need to constantly work on our skills, and that can be tough. And I think the changes most immediately impact women who are likely to have shorter job and career stretches at one single place, who leave large organizations more rapidly, and who, let's face it, are still the primary people when it comes to balancing work and family.
Yeah, it's really interesting, this collision that you talk about of public and private, and something that stands out in a real kind of physical, symbolic, a physical symbol, is you can have a home in a community like this, and you could have a large front porch, maybe rockers on the front porch and a beautiful wreath on the front porch. And round back, there's a huge stockade fence.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
People are spending their time in the back, not on the front porch.
That was really one of the fascinating, and I have to give thanks to Nick Lehman for that, because he was the person who pointed out that what we're doing in our development of our houses is building everything toward the back rather than toward the front. And the organization, man, people's lives were centered toward the front yard. There's a big picture window everyone could see in. The kids were playing on the front lawn. There was one car parked out front. Of course, this was before widespread air conditioning is part of it, but what we're doing is we're building our houses more toward the back. There's more emphasis on privacy. A number of people in Naperville talked about how it was really considered bad form to let your kids cross other people's backyards, even though the backyards kind of come together into a pool. The kids are expected to stay in their own backyard. Stockade fences are definitely going up. And one of the interesting things, you know, I was fascinated to see that the houses that they're building today are much more attractive than the ones they were building in the suburbs, say, 10 years ago. They generally have the garages more toward the back or the side rather than yawning out on the on the street. And they're more attractive and they look homier. And I was interested to see, particularly out in some of the bigger new developments way to the west or the south of town, that a lot of the houses had front porches. And I commented to one of the women in St. Charles, actually, who I was interviewing about this, and she said, check out those front porches that they're building. You can't actually sit on them. They're not wide enough to get a chair and a person in. She said they're there for a decoration, essentially. They're part of the look of a house. And I thought, you know, this says something about where we are in terms of community these days, that the front porch is really more symbolic. I mean, I part of the time I was working on this book, I was staying in a friend's house. She was out of town in Evanston for about a month, on one of those wonderful blocks that's all front porches. And I felt by the end of the week, I knew everybody on her street by the end of the month that I was there. Mm-hmm. And in Naperville, I lived in a townhouse with a little tiny back patio where you couldn't see anybody. And I was there for 2 months, and I don't think I ever saw, much less got to know anybody who lived in the complex where I was. And I don't think these are things that people necessarily want. It's just, you know, it's just the direction we're going in terms of some of the suburban development. And a lot of times structurally it makes it harder to form community.
So how are people finding, you know, meeting their need for community?
They're meeting their need for community in very specific ways, and they are meeting their need for community. I want to stress that. But it's also kind of in a niche-oriented way. One of the women I interviewed said, around here everybody's so busy that they only really have time for the activities that they really enjoy. So joggers meet other joggers, people who are going to recovery groups meet people who are going to recovery groups, people who want to be in Bible study classes meet those people. But there's not that sort of generic getting together of the neighbors that you had in the 50s. It's more centered on what do we have in common, what are our interests in common. Women whose kids are on the soccer team meet each other. Same with the men. But it's much more segmented in that way. And I found it interesting in terms of some of the super churches that are developing. And certainly the western suburbs, we see a lot of the super churches, the mega churches, is that part of their appeal is that even though they're huge, they really focus on small groups and on niches. So there'll be a young mom's group and a divorced dad's group, and it's all segmented in that kind of way, which is another way people develop community. But also, as far as the women go, the women seem to derive an enormous amount of support from their own women's support network, which can be a formalized structure or an extremely informal structure of five women that meet once a month to discuss the issues in their lives. This sort of, what began in the 70s as a sort of consciousness-raising group, has evolved and become really a very strong part of American life. And most of the women I interviewed had some group of women that they were involved with that really gave them a lot of support.
It reminds me again of the metaphor of Starbucks. You know,
yes.
The lattes over here,
exactly.
Cappuccinos here.
Yeah, it's a way of living that echoes the sort of emphasis on the niche that we see more broadly in consumer products.
Let's go and talk with another caller on line two in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. I don't have her book yet. I just turned on the radio just a few minutes ago, and I'm intrigued with her, with your comments and your discussion. We have children living in Naperville, and three grandchildren, and so much of what she said is something that we've observed in the last 4 or 5 years. I did want to make, being a school teacher myself, I did want to retired. Make a plug for their school system. They're really an outstanding school system, and one of the things that makes it so successful, which I think contributes to that community that you're talking about, is the fact that they do involve their parents, and they just literally expect it. And as we all know, that one of the problems of less affluent communities, impoverished communities, is the lack of involvement of parents. And I also wanted to make another comment that I've observed. It seemed like, and you were just discussing that just a minute ago, just going out jogging together, doing things together in the neighborhood,
right,
is that it just seems like their social activities with their children and family is their country club. I really hear very little discussion about country club type of activities, which somehow or another pulls them away from there.
That's very interesting. I agree with that. I in fact, asked some questions about the country club, because there is a big country club right there in the middle of Naperville. Nobody seemed to bring it up in the interviews. And basically what it seemed to be was sort of a golf club for some of the male executives in the region who were particularly interested in golf or had the time to play golf. And the wives who were not working who were really interested in tennis, and that seemed to be about the extent of it. But again, a country club is kind of a generic institution, and what I find is this demise of generic institutions across the board and things coalescing into smaller, much more customized groups.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's one other thing that you mentioned that I think is really extremely important, and I think that does happen in Naperville, and one of the reasons is that there's so many couples working to maintain their economic level in order to live in Naperville, and their youngsters are all involved in so many activities.
Yes.
And I think the one thing that's lacking, and I'm not being critical of our son and his family, because I think they do remarkably well with their children, and that is that the kids don't have enough time to dream. I like that phrase that you use, and I notice our middle granddaughter, who's very active, if she doesn't have anything to do in within a 5-minute period of time, she will say, "I'm bored."
Yeah, exactly. It sort of exacerbates that short attention span, and then also the dependence on the parents of, you know, I'm
right.
bored, I need to be to be entertained. And it's, you know, I have to emphasize, I'm not picking on Naperville here, because this is a problem broadly of, I think, across the U.S.
I've seen it
in everything from small towns to large cities, but it was just so concrete in Naperville to look at the factors that were sort of bringing this together.
Well,
it's interesting. I'm fascinated that both callers
have a connection.
One of the things that has been so extraordinary to me is I don't think I've been almost anywhere in the last year where I haven't met somebody who either lived in Naperville or had relatives in Naperville or had once lived in Naperville. It's amazing, the connections.
Yeah, and there's a sense of pride also that is so good. My one of the other things I'll mention to you here that surprised me, being in music, we went to a Memorial Day parade where our granddaughter was in a Girl Scout activity, and you know, bands are kind of an expensive item. School bands. I've never seen so many school bands from that same community. You know, normally you would have the band from the neighborhood community coming in and so forth. But they had 4 high school bands, a community band, middle school bands, and even the grade schools. And the thing that I liked about that program is that they were not pushy with respect to competing contests and things of that nature that somehow or another pulls the kids away from families because they're always going to competitions and so forth.
Yeah, I really agree with you. I think this whole theme of customization and multiplicity and choice, there's so much choice in the way we live now, and often we just take it for granted. You know, if you go into, looking at contrasts, you know, if you went into a store to buy sneakers in the Organization Man era, you'd have 2 or 3 choices. Today you have hundreds of choices.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I think it's also an overlooked part of our time crunch that we're in. There's so many choices that just negotiating those choices, just choosing, just finding the, you know, right kind of deodorant that we want out of the 90 brand, you know, variations that we see on the shelf, really contributes to the time crunch. But particularly in you know, fairly affluent progressive kind of edge cities like Naperville, just exactly something like the band. I mean, it's not generic anymore. It's specific.
Right.
Tremendous choice and options.
Well, I certainly enjoyed your discussion, and I'll have to get your book.
Thank you. It's Everyday Revolutionaries, Working Women at the Transformation of American Life. And I think I should put in this plug, I'm actually going to be talking this evening at the Borders in Naperville.
Sally Helgeson is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of Everyday Revolutionaries, Working Women and the Transformation of American Life. We've got a caller on line 4 from St. Charles. Hi.
Ah.
Hi.
Hi.
It's an interesting show.
I interviewed a lot of people from St. Charles, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just turned it on, so I wasn't sure, but... Yeah, you don't hear too much in your own area on the radio, but it's an interesting discussion. The one thing that I wanted to comment on was a little while ago you had talked about how neighbors, you know, don't get together much anymore in you know, a social setting, and people tend to join groups and stay with people who they have things in common with, and I've noticed that quite a bit just in my own neighborhood, and I find it a little bit depressing because it seems to me that what I've noticed is that nobody really seems to want to be with anyone who doesn't have their same views. So you don't have kind of a group of people who nobody seems to be tolerant anymore of if someone doesn't, you know, didn't vote for the same person as mayor, or someone who doesn't think development is good, or, you know, for the community. And it seems to me that nobody wants to even socialize with anyone who doesn't think just like them anymore. And I find that kind of depressing. I always like to have a group of people who are different as my friends, because I like to have, you know, versatility, and, you know, I feel depressed about it. I just feel like the neighbors and everybody sort of band together on who voted for which person, and you know, it just seems really kind of sad to me. But,
that's a fabulous point. It's really an important issue, too. I interviewed a number of people who expressed exactly what
really?
You're expressing, and I wonder if, you know, we're seeing this sort of incivility rise up in our culture, particularly in the media. You know, we have shows like Crossfire, where basically people aren't getting together to achieve an understanding. It's just, you know, two people come in with entrenched positions and state them and argue, and there's no attempt to find common ground, and I wonder, you know, I hadn't really put it in this perspective, but if that sort of nicheifying in our communities isn't exacerbating that.
Right.
What I said before about the mega churches, I think you really, even though it's very helpful to have these small group focuses, it goes, you know, when I was growing up at, I mean, church is a place where you'd see, you know, rich and poor and old and young, and, you know, you'd get to know people from very different circumstances, different ages, different situations, and I think that dividing people always up into common interest groups can make it harder for us to develop the skills we need to get along with very different people.
Definitely. I've been in my neighborhood a fairly long time, and I've seen people come and go, and I've seen this more and more now, where if someone doesn't like something that you said or doesn't agree with your opinion, they don't want to be your neighbor. They don't even want to be neighborly sometimes. They don't even want to be a friend. They can't tolerate another opinion.
People are becoming very ideological in that way. Yeah, that's interesting. And I think maybe it is that we don't have enough situations of, you know, sort of common civic coming together that teach us the skills to get along with very different people.
I want to thank that caller for her call. We're
very
here.
Good.
We're here right at the end of our time. And, you know, thinking about some of these things, you know, again, here we're sort of at some... It's sort of new, and yet it's old, because if you look at how we value highly self-reliance and the rights of the individual and property, we've always sort of had, you know, those kinds of core values.
Yes.
So, but maybe now perhaps they're playing out a little differently.
I think so. I think that's what we're seeing. I think we're seeing these aspects of the American character, some of them extremely positive, others like this caller just brought out more problematic, manifest in new ways because of this confluence of changes economically, technologically, and the moving of women into the public arena.
Mm. Sally Helgeson, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, and you'll be at the Borders this evening?
Yes,
in
correct.
Naperville?
Yes.
Okay. And what's next for you?
What's next for me? I've got a few more other radio and television shows, reading at the Old Orchard, Barnes & Noble, on Friday evening. And then I'm off to Denver, but I'll be back in Chicago again for another week in March. I'm giving a speech at the College of DuPage for their Women's Month on March 3rd. I'll be there that evening.
Okay. Well, so if our listeners in the Chicago area or in the DuPage County area can look for you.
Thank you. I enjoyed this show a lot.
Thank you very much for talking with us. Sally Helgeson has been our guest this afternoon. Her name is spelled H-E-L-G-E-S-E-N. And we've been talking with her about Everyday Revolutionaries, her new book, Everyday Revolutionaries, Working Women in the Transformation of American Life. It's published by Doubleday. And Sally joined us this afternoon from the Radio Hall of Fame studios at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. And our thanks this afternoon to the museum for their help with the program. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Matt Hageman.
We don't have the settlements yet from the Chicago Board of Trade. However, on the last tick, wheat was up, corn was up a couple of cents, and soybeans also up. We're going to do the prices from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange first. For those, back to Celeste.
Okay.